Today's episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Season 2 of the podcast Blowback, exclusively available on Stitcher Premium. After a critically acclaimed retelling of the Iraq War, Season 2 of Blowback, co-hosted by Brendan James and Noah Colwin, is a 10-part account of the unlikely story of the Cuban Revolution. It's a nuclear tip showdown between the Kennedy brothers, Fidel Castro, the Soviet Union, the CIA, and the Mafia. To listen now and get a free month of Stitcher Premium, go to stitcher.com/premium. Enter the promo code MAJORITY when you select a monthly plan. That's stitcher.com/premium, promo code MAJORITY. We had at least Brendan, I think, on back when they did the first episode of the first series of this on Friend of Show. John Benjamin participated in that one. This one I am super psyched to check out. That is promo code MAJORITY at stitcher.com/premium. And now for this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, May 3rd, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the 5-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, freelance journalist and author of Prisons Make Us Safer and 20 other myths about mass incarceration, Victoria Law will be joining us. Also on the program today, India on fire, more than 400,000 new COVID cases on Saturday, as the White House now imposes travel restrictions from India. Democrats' unity fraying on the infrastructure bill as the corporatists push back on new taxes for the rich. Speaking of which, President Joe Manchin has now come out publicly stymieing statehood for Washington, D.C. All the while, Democratic House retirements threaten the majority. It's one of those use it because you're probably going to lose it moments. Biden cancels the border wall projects that were from the diverted funds from the military. AP reports progress on the Iran nuclear deal talks. White House suspends Trump's loosening of drone rules, which allowed for a little less certainty about whether civilian casualties would take place. The government ineffectiveness myth takes a bit of a hit. Private companies wasted more vaccinations than most government agencies combined. And new report shows the third round of COVID relief checks led to the largest household income rise in 60 years. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us at the beginning of this week. Joining me as well, of course, as she does every day, Emma Vigeland. Emma, hello. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. My son is starting 5 days a week school starting tomorrow. That's exciting.
4 days a week this week, but yeah.
Well, you know, he's into it. Yeah. 4 days. The teachers had to get ready. They had to set up classrooms. They had to.
That's exciting.
It is exciting. And of course, you know, the new CDC guidelines about if you're outside and you're not around a bunch of people, you know, like crowds, I should say, no mask. I notice in Brooklyn, still a lot of mask wearing. I think people are going to ease into it. But I find myself, I wear it on my chin when I'm walking to work now, which I quite enjoy, not the chin part, but just not having it over the face. But I also want to signal, like, it's still going on out there. People got to be careful.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed when I walked to work this morning, I totally forgot to take it down, and I wanted to enjoy because it's a little warmer out. But I got to the office. I was like, oh, well. Because, I mean, we're just so used to it at this point. I don't really notice.
Well, and good
Although
for
Tucker
you.
Although Tucker Carlson would say, obviously, I should be
I was gonna
thrown
say,
in jail. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. The horror of anything that would, any type of theater that would indicate, hey, we still need to be concerned about people who haven't gotten vaccinated, either by choice or because they can't, because maybe they're immunosuppressed, maybe they are going through cancer treatment, maybe they're under the age of 16, whatever it is. And the idea that there would be people out there who are just angry about this, that there are people who are going to sort of like ease into it and be overly cautious, is, and the amazing thing is too, is that, like, you know, we're not living in shutdowns. I mean, most places, there are some places, I think, in the country where there's still some, you know, it's raging. But for the most part, we're not living with shutdowns. The economy is better today. It's not great, but it's better today than it has been at any other time in the past year. Mm-hmm. So the idea that people would just get mad about the fact that other people are wearing masks is, I think that those people really need to sort of do a self-check and maybe talk to a therapist.
Live and let live, Tucker. Live and let live.
Well, it's not just Tucker Carlson. I mean, it's just like there's a whole movement around this, it seems like.
Yeah, it's odd. The personal responsibility people seem to be the most triggered by the actions of others.
It really is sort of stunning that way. Yeah. All right, let's play this clip. We've reported that Austin, Texas, has at different times over the past couple of months cut parts of their police budget to purchase hotels for unhoused people to live in. We have a massive homelessness problem in this country. There are approximately 700,000 unhoused people. About 200,000 of those people are unsheltered. Or 200,000 to 300,000 are unsheltered. And these are rough numbers, obviously. And by unsheltered, I mean, like, they're not being provided with any type of, like, temporary sheltering. And temporary sheltering is a different type of problem insofar as it does not solve the problem. So here is how Austin, Texas voters apparently responded to what are, you know, small tent encampments that are happening in Austin, Texas, and how overjoyed. We should say there are 17 million empty homes per the Census Bureau in 2019. This is how Fox and Friends and the Republican in charge of this referendum campaign celebrated this weekend by essentially criminalizing people trying to find a place to sleep in a tent.
People of Austin, Texas, taking a stand against the city's homeless crisis. Over the weekend, more than 85,000 voted in favor of bringing back the ban on public camping after the city's Democratic mayor rescinded that law 2 years ago. Save Austin Now is the political action committee behind the push to reinstate the ban. And its founder, Travis County Republican Party Chair Matt Makowiak, joins us now. Hey, Matt.
Good morning, Ainsley.
Good morning. Thanks for being on with us. You had a great weekend.
We did, but more importantly, our city had a great weekend. You know, we were right up along the edge of the abyss, looking mm-hmm. down, and I think our city took a major step backwards, actually. But by taking that step backwards, we took a major step forwards. Our city's never been less safe than it is right now. I've lived here since 1984, and the homeless camping ordinance has really been destroying our city, destroying every neighborhood, every major intersection, every city park. It's simply not working. In fact, a camping ordinance has never worked anywhere it's ever been tried. If you've been to Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Honolulu, you know this firsthand. And so we had an overwhelming victory over the weekend. We've worked for the last 10 weeks since this issue was put on the ballot. And we believe we won 40% of Democratic votes, 88% of independent votes, and 92% of Republican votes in one of the more progressive cities in the country. We think that's a model that can be used in other cities as well. And we're excited that we took this specific action to restore public safety and public health for our city and for our citizens.
It's unbelievable that some of these leaders want to allow this, even for their own safety, for the homeless population's safety. There's got to be a better solution.
Yeah, well,
She may be on to something.
Why don't you talk about some of those solutions, maybe? Perhaps actually providing housing for people instead of treating having a roof over your head as some sort of privilege only afforded to the bootstrapped few. But this Prop B, which I believe is being introduced throughout the state, am I wrong?
I'm not 100% sure where it goes next.
Yeah, but it's backed by millions of dollars in Republican cash, and it was an attempt to basically penalize the Austin City Council for putting more progressive houseless measures in place to deal with people humanely and make sure that we aren't just this incredibly callous society. It criminalizes panhandling, camping, sleeping on public sidewalks, or even sitting on public sidewalks, meaning that it could be subject to fines. And they say, oh, we're not going to throw homeless people in jail or houseless people in jail. But what happens when the poorest among us cannot pay the fines that you're going to level at them?
Hundreds of dollars worth of fines. And of course, it also puts these folks in, gives the police officers, the cops, a perfect opportunity to interact with people and roll them up. And so this is going to end up, essentially, you're criminalizing being unhoused. The organizers in Austin are saying that they were spent 10 to 1, outspent, I should say, 10 to 1 on the vote, of course.
And it's not a lot of money on the protecting houseless people side of things.
No. And this story of just sort of criminalizing another group of people and the dynamic here, sadly, dovetails nicely with what our next guest is going to talk about. We will be right back and talk to Victoria Law. She's a freelance journalist and author of Prisons Make Us Safer and 20 Other Myths About Mass Incarceration. We'll be right back after this. Folks, one of the things that you know, that I am incredibly efficient with my time, which is actually true. I realized the other day, like,
You don't dilly-dally.
I don't dilly-dally. I don't dilly-dally.
Or dawdle.
I don't dawdle. I mean, how do I justify taking a walk to work? I mean, now that I'm back, I could take on the subway, save myself 10 minutes, 10, 15, 20 minutes. Well, how do I justify that? Multitask. How do I multitask? Well, some days what I do is I use my app called Blinkist. Why? Because Blinkist is for anyone who cares about learning but doesn't have a lot of time. And those two things describe me. What it does is it takes the key ideas from over something like 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories. It gathers them together into 15-minute text, which I tend not to use because I'm walking. I can't read it. Or audio explainers, or what they call blinks. And you use Blinks for any different things. One, so you can get into a topic quickly, or you find new topics that you're interested in, test them out. You don't have to make too much of a commitment. Same with books. Hey, maybe I'll read this book. I don't know. What's it about? I'm not sure. I'm going to check my Blink. For me, it's also, I have a couple of different subsets. I will use Blinkist to look at books that maybe I don't necessarily want to read, but, you know, feel like I should have some passing awareness of, just in case I ever in my life ever go to a cocktail party, which I don't think I ever have, but it's possible as I age, maybe. Right. So maybe that's how I'll check out Blowout by Rachel Maddow, for instance. But I also have things like where I'm like, hey, I want the key takeaways. I don't need everything else. I'm not going to read the prose. And I did that with The Barefoot Investor because I was like, you know what? I have no idea about like how personal finance or anything like that. So I checked that out, but I'm not going to read the whole book. I'm sorry. I'm not going to do it. And Blinkist has even teamed up with popular podcasts and have created Blinks for those too. So you can get to the heart of the podcast episode fast. I don't know about this one. I think you could probably do that just if you had some type of program to take out all of my ahs and ums, but forget that for a second. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge, like I said, in 27 nonfiction categories like self-improvement, management, mindfulness, and more. You can check it out, folks. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for just our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority report. You start your 7-day free trial, and then you get 25% off of Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/majority report to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/majority report. Check it out. We will put the that information in our podcast and YouTube description, as will we do with Liquid IV. Every day now, I start my day, and then I, through the course of the show, and frankly, over the weekend too, because I'm out there, I'm doing yard work, or I'm doing like, I'm doing a little baseball coaching, well, assistant coaching, Pony League, never mind, that's exhausting, believe me. I'm feeling a little dehydrated, I don't want to get dehydrated, Liquid IV. They have a hydration multiplier plus immune support at the moment is their latest flavor. It's tangerine. It's delicious. I mix it up. Sometimes I go with the immune support. Sometimes I go with my green sort of matcha version for energy.
That seems to be your favorite.
That is my favorite, but I'm trying to cut back a little bit on it. It's the equivalent of like of 2 cups of coffee from the matcha.
Gotcha.
But I'm trying to go back, you know, cut back on that. So I've been doing the immune support. It's got vitamin C. It's got zinc. It's got Wellmune. And, you know, Liquid IV, it's got that cellular transport technology, which allows for rapid uptake, intake of other nutrients in and the absorption of water. But today, I tried the strawberry. And it's delicious.
You were telling me that before the show. So, jury's in. You liked it?
I like it.
I like strawberry, too. You know, I like the acai most, but the strawberry one is my, you know, home flavor. I got a bunch of strawberry at my apartment.
I'm about to make one of the most embarrassing... I don't know why it's embarrassing, but...
It's because you're embarrassed. You told me this anecdote before the show. You're reliving embarrassment from college.
So, they have a pina colada flavor, and I love it. And I have been known amongst some of my friends as always opting for a pina colada if that's ever an option at a bar.
So there you go. That's you felt like that was girly in college, and now you're feeling...
It's not so much that it's girly. It's just that, like, it's sort of like that's the drink you have, like you have virgin pina coladas when you're a kid.
I'm a huge spicy margarita. Oh, I used to have virgin daiquiris, but that's beside the point.
Yeah, well, I'm a pina colada guy. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. I don't know what to tell you. But Liquid IV can provide 2 to 3 times more hydration than water alone. With every purchase, Liquid IV donates a serving of Liquid IV to someone in need. The company's donated over 10 million servings globally, including 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. You can get your Liquid IV's hydration multiplier plus immune support in bulk at Costco, or you can order online and get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. It's 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. In fact, strawberry, folks. All right. Now I'd like to welcome to the program, back to the program, Victoria Law. She is a freelance journalist and author of Prisons Make Us Safer and 20 other myths about mass incarceration. Victoria, thanks for joining us again. I know we talked a couple of months ago in the wake of the reports of the increase in Asian hate and the failure of incarceration to really address that. But welcome back. I'm here with Emma Vigeland, and congratulations on the book.
Thanks. And thanks, Sam and Emma, for having me back.
So let's start in with what you see as the biggest myth. I mean, maybe the giveaway is on the book, but I mean, Let's start this way, since that's a pretty easy spoiler alert. But let's start with this. Like, presumably, when society looks at prisons, what presumably do prisons, what function do they serve, presumably?
So presumably, imprisoning somebody or prisons serve the function of one of three things: deterrence. So people are afraid of being imprisoned, so this deters them from harmful behaviors or illegal behaviors. Incapacitation, so you remove that person from society and they are no longer at large in the community or at risk to other people in the community. And the third myth about mass incarceration is that it provides some sort of justice for the victims that somebody has harmed. So these are the prevalent myths about why we need mass incarceration. And that's actually not the case. People are not deterred by threats of imprisonment. As we talked about in the last time I was on your show, we see this rise in anti-Asian violence, and that has not been deterred by hate crime laws, more policing, more outrage about the situation, people being arrested. It does incapacitate people, but eventually people are released from prison and it doesn't stop. And it ignores the fact that there is violence prevalent in the prisons at the same time. So you just move somebody from one situation to another and you don't address harmful, illegal, and violent behaviors. And many victims don't feel a sense of closure or justice just because the person has been taken away. It doesn't address many of the other needs they might have, say for medical care or, you know, mental health counseling if they've been traumatized by a violent attack. Maybe they need to take time off of work because of, you know, the violence they suffered, and that doesn't cover that either.
Can you talk about specifically the lack of deterrence, the myth about deterrence in regards to sexual assault, rape, sexual violence in general? Because I think that the lack of justice in the traditional sense when it comes to those crimes is an especially stark example of how our current imagining of a justice system that includes the threat of imprisonment, it has failed in so many ways.
Yes. I mean, what we see in the traditional police, prosecution, and prison system is that, in fact, it does not actually provide a lot of justice for people who have suffered sexual assault in the first place. I mean, according to the Department of Justice's own victims reporting and crime victims reporting reports, only 230 of every 1,000 rapes are reported to the police. So that's less than one quarter. And from there, the numbers just get smaller. Only 46 lead to arrests. So that's about 20% of that, you know, very small number. Only 9 are referred to prosecution. And of those, only 5 result in a conviction. So that is a startlingly small statistic. And people are not deterred from sexually assaulting people because, A, they know that it is not an act or a crime that is taken seriously in many instances. We live in a society where again and again and again, men are taught that women's bodies or women's nose are not to be taken seriously, like that they have access to this. We live in a society that sexualizes girls and young women from a very young age. And again, there is not this idea that people are deterred by the threat of prison, because the threat of prison, if it is on somebody's horizon, is how can I do this thing and avoid going to prison, not I should not do this harmful action because I will go to prison at some point.
And how do we assess that, just the premise, the top line of your book? Like, I mean, how do we say that prisons don't make us safer? If someone says, well, look, I don't know what the recidivism rate is or the rate which people commit multiple, let's say, violent crimes, I don't. If this guy gets locked up, I don't care if he's rehabilitated. I'm not interested in that. I just want him off the streets so he can't harm someone else. How do we know that doesn't work, or do we know? Or so how do, in that instance, when someone says that, as for, you know, making it safer, how do we know that that's not the case?
Well, what we see again and again is that people who go to prison don't come out, quote unquote, rehabilitated. And the majority of people in prison do come out. They return back to the same communities that are often under-resourced and have lack of opportunities for people to actually do meaningful things in their lives or be able to get help for any underlying mental health or anger management or whatever, things that drove them to do this harmful behavior in the first place. And in addition, they now have a felony record, which closes even these small doors of opportunities to them. And in the meantime, they've spent 1, 2, 3, 5 years in a loud, chaotic, violent environment that actually teaches us the opposite of what we want to teach all of our kindergartners. Don't hit, use your words, you know, like take a deep breath, don't have outbursts, don't throw tantrums, don't throw bodily fluids at people, et cetera, et cetera. And instead, they're put in this environment where all of that is topsy-turvy. And you are taught that you have to, you know, that you have to fight, you have to be aggressive, you have to not seem like you are weak. And these are not things that we actually want in our society. We don't want a bunch of people running around trying to be the biggest bully, but that's what prison conditions people to do. So people come home, they have a lack of opportunity, and what they then have are skills and behaviors that they've learned in order to survive in prison, which leads to then more harm and more criminal activity. I mean, we see people who have repeat offenses is that it starts small, burglary, theft, something else, and it starts to gradually increase. And then you're like, okay, so this person was incarcerated at age 12 for breaking into the department store and stealing X number of, you know, items. Then at age 16, they were arrested for dealing drugs. And then at age, you know, 20, they were arrested for assault, and it keeps going up. So obviously imprisonment has not taught them not to engage in criminal behaviors or violent behaviors. And I would say it actually does the opposite. I mean, there's also the school of thought that prisons are training grounds for career criminals because you learn to get away with more things. You learn other behaviors that we don't actually want people to learn when they come home, to have when they come home. Instead of learning how to take that ability to like calculate numbers and everything else that you might have if you were dealing illicit substances and taking that and using it in some legalized way, you're going to be figuring out like, oh, I can do this, that, or the other instead and make myself a quick buck, especially since my options for legal employment are closed.
I mean, essentially, particularly, you know, when we're talking about younger people, we're sending them to a vocational school. It just so happens that instead of like learning a trade like plumbing or electricity or construction, it's how to do crime, essentially. Talk about the myth that private prisons drive mass incarceration.
So that has been the myth that private prisons drive mass incarceration has been very prevalent over the past decade as more and more people are aware that we have 2.2 million people behind bars. But private prisons didn't come into play until the 1980s when prison populations were already on the rise and private corporations saw an opportunity to make money off of caging people. But while they incarcerate, while the United States has about 2.2 million people in prison, only 8% of people in prison are in privately run prisons. That's different than in immigration detention, where the private corporations run 73% of immigration detention facilities. But in terms of imprisonment, where you go to court, you're convicted, you're sentenced to X number of years in prison, it's not a very large number of people in private prisons. And even if you close private prisons, which we've seen in several states such as Kentucky, people are not necessarily released. They're just shuffled into government-run prisons. It's not that Kentucky said, okay, let's look at everybody that is now in prison and who can we safely release to be able to reduce the prison population so we no longer need to contract with this private company. Instead, what they do is they say, okay, we're no longer contracting with this private company because they have a horrible record of abuses and injustices and terrible conditions. So we're shuffling everybody back into our government-run prisons, which may also have a terrible record of abuses, injustices, and terrible conditions, but they are government-run, not privately run.
Let's deal with the myths. I mean, we just told the story of Austin, Texas, where a referendum, where apparently there was a tremendous amount of money behind this, has almost like recriminalized being homeless. Having a house has become, you know, according to this referendum, more or less an opportunity for police to come and interact with you and give you a whole array of these police, a whole array of things in which they could ticket you for. You get fined. Obviously, you're not making a lot of money. Go home. And so how does there are myths around prisons, you know, dealing with issues of substance abuse, issues with, you know, mental problems that folks might be having, and that it deals with all the sort of like ancillary impacts of being homeless, that, it, you know, at the very least, you'll get three square and you'll get some type of treatment for any type of issues. And, you know, part of that is built into the myths of what makes people homeless, which is lack of affordable housing. But talk about the myths about what prison addresses in terms of people's societal problems, I guess.
Yes. So there is a myth that people will get treatment in prison, whether it's mental health treatment, drug treatment, medical care, that many of us on the outside cannot get easily. And what this myth does is it perpetuates the idea that some people are better off when they are locked away because they get this treatment. But in reality, people actually don't get mental health treatment. In many jails and prisons around the country, even those that call themselves like mental health jails, there's a severe shortage of mental health staff. People are told that they should be medicated. So when people go and they say, I'm suffering from X, Y, and Z, the answer is to medicate them. Many people don't want to take medication because it makes them feel slow. They don't like the side effects. They don't feel like it helps. But there's not a deeper trying to grapple with what is happening with this person that is causing these things. In many cases, too, people are unable to access mental health and medical care. I mean, we saw this most starkly this past year when the coronavirus swept through jails and prisons, where people would try to access medical care to say, we just realized the guy serving food in our unit came down with COVID. We don't feel so well. We would all like to go get COVID tested. This happened at Rikers Island in March or April of last year. And instead of bringing these people to the medical unit, which would have benefited everybody, including the correctional officers who had to be in close contact with people on that unit, they pepper sprayed them. And so, like, that is not in anybody's books good medical care, good COVID protocol. So there is this barrier to medical and mental health care that people also have. And then there's also just a lack of that kind of care in the first place. There's often staff shortages. There's often one or two providers for facilities that have hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And then there aren't enough slots. So there aren't enough slots in counseling groups. There aren't enough drug treatment slots for everybody who's in there. So many people just languish. And again, I said that prisons are places of violence and abuse and chaos, and they're loud and they're chaotic. And these often exacerbate people's existing mental health conditions. So it's not like anybody gets better while they are in prison because they are in prison.
One of the myths that you talk about is that people are in prison for nonviolent drug offenses, and if we let them out, we'll end mass incarceration. And that's not the case. Give us a sense of like who exactly is in prison, or for what, you know, for what, I guess.
So over the past few years, we've seen radical changes to drug laws in several states and jurisdictions, which have reduced the number of people being sent to prison specifically for nonviolent drug offenses. I mean, in the early 2000s, New York repealed its Rockefeller drug laws, which stated that if you had 2 to 4 ounces of a narcotic substance such as cocaine or crack cocaine, you would face a mandatory 15 years to life sentence. And that swelled the prison population. We have similar laws in other states. But over the years, thanks to advocates and including people who do work around drug policies, those laws have been repealed and we're not sending as many people to prison for these nonviolent drug laws. But what we see is that in prisons, there's actually a large number of people who are imprisoned for so-called violent offenses. And I say so-called because prosecutors decide whether to charge somebody with what's seen as a violent offense, even if they actually committed no violence against a person. So in some states, burglary can be considered a violent offense because you enter somebody else's home illegally with the intent to rob them or commit some sort of felony. So you may not have hurt somebody in the process of entering their home, but somebody was in the home and could have been hurt. There are all sorts of laws that charge people as quote unquote violent offenders when they actually did not commit any violence. And then there are people who do harm other people. I don't want to say the majority of people in there do not harm other people, but they are also in prison. So if you let out people who are incarcerated for nonviolent drug offenses, you're still going to have a gigantic population behind bars. So it only frees up a small share of the prison population. We saw this in Oklahoma a few years ago when they commuted the sentences of a few hundred people convicted of nonviolent drug offenses, and the prison still remained overcrowded. Women in the largest Oklahoma women's prison reported that you could not walk down the hallway without brushing against other people because that is how crowded it was, even after hundreds of people had been commuted and freed from prisons.
So if the situations, I'm leading to another myth here, that if the situation in prison is so bad, why do we not hear more about prisoners resisting or organizing? I know the answer to this, but you tell us.
So prison walls are very good at keeping people in, and they're also very good at keeping information inside. And until recently, many news outlets were not that interested in covering what was happening in prisons, unless it was a gigantic riot, a la the 1971 Attica Rebellion, where prisoners took over portions of the prison, held guards hostages, and issued a series of demands for better prison conditions. They weren't saying, you know, give us a plane and fly us to Cuba or something. They were saying, we want to be treated like people, not like animals. And what we see again and again is that it's hard for people in prison to get information out. News outlets aren't very interested in covering it. That's been changing more and more in recent years. But then also some of this resistance is not necessarily headline breaking or, you know, considered newsworthy. So groups of women sitting in the law library helping each other with paperwork around family court to make sure that their children or other women's children are not taken from them permanently is not considered a very sexy news story, but it is a form of resistance that happens. What we see instead is that, you know, we see headlines about mass hunger strikes that happen very infrequently, and sometimes people aren't able to get that kind of news out in the first place. So in California in 2011 and 2013, people in the men's Pelican Bay State Prison who were locked into isolation units for 23 and a half to 24 hours a day indefinitely with no end to their solitary confinement in sight, launched a mass hunger strike. So the first one was for 3 weeks. The second one followed a few months later. It was also for 3 weeks. The third one in 2013 lasted for 3 months and swept across California so that men and women in other state prisons, even those not in solitary confinement, took place. And that grabbed headlines because it was a mass hunger strike. But 10 people engaging in a hunger strike in a prison in Alabama may not get that same reaction from media, because by the time anybody finds out about this hunger strike, often it's over. or it's hard to get more information about what is happening because people have been sequestered away from phones or anybody who can get this information out. And at the same time, again, especially today in this chaotic news cycle, it's hard to get attention to these kinds of issues. And then there's also, again, this idea that people who are in prison are the worst of the worst, or we should not care about what their conditions are because if you do the crime, you should do the time. And why are you complaining that you're not being fed adequately or you're being locked in a cell the size of a small bathroom for 23 hours a day?
I seem to remember, and I have no ability to track of time. I don't know if it was a couple of years ago, there was a strike in I think it was in Alabama. I think,
yes.
And they were attempting to coordinate with other prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from the outside, from someone who was actually actively looking for information. It was very, very hard to find information. Never mind, I imagine, for them to try and coordinate these things. And it just sort of melted away because of the complete lack of the ability, I guess what I'm saying is to sequester anything like that and keep it from actually reaching outside of the prison walls is just enormous, obviously. I mean, the whole thing is a system of control.
Yes.
All right. So let's talk about is this a situation of prisons were just simply a bad idea from the beginning, or what, did it go off the rails at one point? Was there a better conception of what these places were supposed to be before we move into what kind of reforms?
So prisons, when they first started, so before we had prisons, people were detained while they were awaiting sentence, and the sentences were brutal, floggings, being put in the stocks, being executed. So that was terrible. I'm not saying that we should go back to the days of flogging people. But there was this idea that we would imprison people, and the Quakers actually came up with the idea of the penitentiary, where people would sit in isolation and they were supposed to reflect on their sins and pray to God and be penitents. And they were kept in total isolation. They never saw another person. They never heard anything. But instead, many people went mad. And then at the same time, there was another type of prison that evolved called the Auburn State Prison, where people were kept in total isolation for a good part of the day. And then they were allowed to come out and do basically factory work, but they were not allowed to talk to each other. There was no conversation. Everything had to be in total silence. This was enforced by guards and the threat of violence and brutality. And then when they were done making hats or shoes or whatever they were making, they were ushered back into their cells to be totally silent and supposedly reflect upon their sins and pray to God that they did not commit such sins again. So neither of these systems did very much to rehabilitate people. Neither of these systems did anything to address root causes of why people were committing crimes, whether they were poor, whether they had committed adultery, whether they had violated any of the laws and the norms at the times. So we fast forward to the 20th and 21st century. In the 1970s, there was actually a governmental commission the National Advisory Commission on Criminal Justice Standards, found that prisons actually didn't work. And they had only achieved a shocking record of failure. And they recommended that no more prisons be built and that all juvenile facilities be closed. And around that same time, we start to see Nixon ramping up his war on crime, his conflating the civil rights movement, where Black people were demanding their right to equality and equal access to things that had been white only, with crime. So he said, there's this increase in street crime. How can we have this country of law and order where people can decide for themselves what laws they want to obey? And he wasn't talking about, street crime actually that was happening. He was talking about the civil rights movement. So you can see that as a dog whistle. And that started to be the start of increasing policing and in prosecution and imprisonment of Black and brown people throughout the nation. So there's this idea that we put people away and they're supposed to reflect and, repent and be rehabilitated magically when they come out. And what we end up with is this racialized control of populations who are demanding their rights and populations who have never had the same economic, social, or political opportunities as their white peers.
You mentioned the Quakers. Is there something inherently American about this concept of punishment, repentance? I mean, there's obviously a religious element to the underpinning too, and of course the racial element. But you know, I think about more secular countries like Norway or wherever, their concept of prison is a lot different. So can you expand upon that a bit?
Yes. So Norway actually picked up on the Quaker model early on and built these fortress-like prisons as well. And then sometime in the 20th century jettisoned that for what we now know call like the Norway model, which is some of their prisons, not all of them, are these more open prisons, which are run more like, I don't know, really nice college campuses, where people have, you know, like rooms to themselves. They have educational opportunities. They have vocational opportunities. They can see their families. But remember, the prison population of Norway is about 4,000. When I was writing the book early on, I went to go see a talk by, I cannot pronounce his name and I will not mangle it, but the director of Norway's prison system was giving a talk about his prison system. And he said that the day before the talk, he had gone to Rikers Island to go tour it. And he was like, this jail, Rikers Island, is a island with 10 jail buildings. And he said, our entire country's prison population can fit into one corner of this gigantic island. So we have to remember that Norway's prison population is 4,000. They don't have things like the death penalty or life sentences. And they treat people as if and that they are going to be your neighbors and community members and family members. So let us make them be better when they come out. Not let us put them away for X number of years and kind of forget about them, but let us work towards rehabilitating them and making it so that they can reintegrate. But we also have to remember Norway has a very robust social services system that our country does not have. So to answer your question, yes, you know, like the more secular countries have that, but they also have what we don't have, which is a better safety net. So that way, and an understanding that people who are going to prison and in prison are going to be coming out and are going to be living among us again. So it is not the lock them up and throw away the key model that we have. It is the, so Johan has done something terrible and he's going to go away for 1.5 years. How do we make sure Johan comes back out and is not going to do these things again?
Yeah, well, I mean, and then it just to just build on that, the social safety net aspect also brings it back to how I think Americans view suffering as inherently, you know, like, you know, repentance and suffering and doing your time and reflecting as, you know, something that's inherently moral. And I think that roots back to Puritanism, but you know, yes. That's just something I would add. It's all under the same umbrella, really.
Yes.
Well, so okay, so let's talk about some of the sort of the alternate visions that we could have as a response to crime, I guess the first question I have is, can we just reform the idea of our carceral state without having greater reform for our society? I mean, you know, do we need a more robust sort of like social system where government is providing for people more before that we can do reform on the carceral state? Or what's the relationship between that?
Well, I think, yes. First of all, a short answer, yes. But I mean, earlier we talked about increased criminalization of homelessness and people who are homeless for very petty acts, which if they were inside a home, would not be criminalized, right? You can, like when you have a home, you presume your home has a toilet, so you can go to the bathroom in your own bathroom. But when you're homeless, you might be peeing on the street. You know, if you drink alcohol, you might be drinking a beer on the street. Whereas nobody criminalizes you these days for drinking a beer inside your own home. So putting those resources into very necessary supports like affordable housing, why does Austin have such a large homeless population? And why is the response to criminalize rather than to say, let's build some housing so that that way we can get people off the street? We saw the same thing in Atlanta in the 1990s when the Olympics were coming up, is that Atlanta built a, I forget if it was 11-story or 17-story detention center specifically for people who violated city ordinances, mostly homeless people, drinking a beer on the street, walking in the middle of the roadway. If any of your viewers have been to Atlanta and tried to walk from one place to another, you will be walking and the sidewalk literally ends. And you, the next, you know, step you take, you are actually in the middle of the street or the roadway. Now, I have walked in the middle of the roadway many times because I needed to get from point A to point B. Now, no police officer has ever stopped me, warned me, arrested me, ticketed me. But when you are homeless and you are doing this, you are an easy target for these types of things. So have a better public transportation system, have housing, have mental health treatment. Don't wait until people commit criminalized acts to be able to do that, to supposedly provide them with, you know, three supposedly hot meals, which many people say they don't actually get when they are incarcerated, you know, and a slab of concrete to sleep on, you know, actually put that money into these kinds of things. And it would actually be cheaper. I mean, there have been studies that show that it costs between, depending on the state, $31,000 to $55,000. And that cost goes up the older people get, the sicker people get to imprison them. So it would be much cheaper to build affordable housing and put them there.
Is that $30,000 to $50,000 annually, which not over the course of their imprisonment? I mean, this is
annually. This is one person per year, and you multiply that by thousands.
I mean, so like, you know, the big thing for people to get over is this idea that, hey, you know, just to use the Norway model, like I don't want to send someone who committed a crime to a sort of like a place that looks like a college campus. It's not a question of efficacy. It's not a question of expenditure. It's not a question of anything other than just sort of this innate feeling that we need to punish that person. Level. It's not a question of rehabilitation, because obviously that's far more effective. So let's talk a little bit about restorative justice. I mean, how does that work? And do we have examples in practice? I can only tell you that, like, I had spoken to someone who worked in the family court system in Brooklyn, and they represent people who have been abused. They told me that, you know, one of the problems with the restorative justice that is some parts of the court system are being used is that the person who's abused doesn't want to get to engage with that abuser again. Like, how do you deal with issues like that? Like, what's sort of the rubber meets the road on some of these things?
So restorative justice is this idea that instead of going to the criminal justice system, police, prosecutions, and the hopes of imprisonment and taking that person away from society, it's that there are two parties. There's the person who did the harm, what we would call like the defendant, or, you know, like the perpetrator in criminal justice terms, and then the person who was harmed, or the victim, or the survivor. And what restorative justice attempts to do is look at what does the victim or the survivor need in order to be healed, right? You know, like, so not just they need this person to be away from them, but also like, what else do you need? Do you need counseling? Do you need like trauma-based services? Do you need medical care? You know, like, do you need long-term medical care, perhaps? Not just like the short-term, you know, your eye was blackened and, you know, like, or this, you know, like your arm was broken, but also what longer-term medical care might you need? What do you need in terms of housing, job support, you know, childcare, family court things, if you have children with this person? And then what does this person need to take responsibility for their actions and try to make amends? And it doesn't always work in a domestic violence situation, because again, there's like a long-term pattern of abuse. So before people end up in family court, it's not because the abuse happened one time. It happened multiple times. I mean, we have studies that show that in most abusive relationships, it takes 7 to 10 times when a survivor tries to leave before it actually takes hold. not because they have like some lack of will, but because there are all these other forces that happen. Again, going back to your question about institutional resources, there might be a lack of affordable housing. Where can I go, you know, that I can afford and I can be in a neighborhood that is safe? If there are children, where can I go? I rely on this person to do childcare sometimes, or we split the childcare bill, or that, you know, this person's job is the one that provides the childcare. What do we do about schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of other crime, other violent crime that happens, I would point to Common Justice that operates in New York City, which works with youth ages 16 to 24, 25, who have committed violent acts. And what they do is they go to the criminal courts and they identify people who are facing criminal charges for things like assault, you know, robbery, things that we would typically just be like, you get 5 to 10 years in prison, go away and come back out worse. And first they go to the people who have been harmed and they explain what the program is. And they ask them, would you like to participate? And I spoke to one outreach person who said that what happens is at first the survivor just vents, and you know, like they're all of their anger and their turmoil and their emotion about having been mugged or, you know, like assaulted. And it's like, and then at the end of this, they say, okay, so if I participated in this, this means this person will have to be accountable. They have to like take responsibility for their actions. And that means that they are much less likely to do this again to somebody, to me or to somebody else in the future. And 90% of the time they say, okay, let's try this restorative justice model, because we know that this typical going to court, having to testify and hoping that this person gets convicted will actually do something. And we have to remember that even according to the Department of Justice, over half of all violent crimes are not reported in the first place. So restorative justice is a model that's been looked at more in recent years. And I want to be clear that it comes from Native American and Maori communities that have been practicing this for generations. And only recently has kind of taken hold in the United States as a possible model that is not necessarily, you take somebody out and you have this adversarial model where the person who did the harm says, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't hit them that hard, it wasn't that bad, they're exaggerating, and never has to take responsibility for their actions, versus somebody who has to say, oh, I did that, and not only did I rob you or punch you or assault you, but now I am the person that causes you to fear to go out at night. I'm the person that causes you to have their heart racing and their, you know, and to be sweating and to be anxious anytime you hear footsteps behind you. Like, these are all the things that I did. It's not just that I did this one single incident, but I've actually caused this, you know, and now I have to hear from your mother and your sister and your, you know, spouse and your children, the effects that my action has had on you. And my family members are like, what did you do? You know, and they're holding me responsible for these actions and saying, what can you do to make sure this never happens again and try to start healing the damage you caused?
Do we have any data? Like, I mean, is there any way to sort of measure? Because I think for a lot of people, you know, the idea that there's an accountability that is sort of intrinsic in someone's person, as opposed to a system imposing accountability on somebody who may not really actually reckon with what they've done, you know, when people are contemplating the idea of rehabilitation, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, do we have, is there any place in the country that has made these reforms sufficiently to sort of assess? Because on some level, the model here is, right, is like, we're going to redeploy. I mean, it's almost like defund the prisons. We're going to redeploy the tens of thousands of dollars a year that we spend on incarcerating somebody, and we're going to redeploy that money into providing the victim with certain restitution, with certain restorative measures, and perhaps and providing the perpetrator with some type of services to actually genuinely rehabilitate them. Is there a pilot program somewhere, or I mean, has this been attempted in a way that we could actually look at some data?
So there's actually been research done in the U.S., Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom that show that restorative justice breaks the cycle of violence and reduces recidivism rates by as much as 44%, which is much better than the traditional prison system where people go in and they come out, and oftentimes they go back in again and they recidivate over and over and over. So the research shows that restorative justice, I think because people are made to take more accountability, and I want to be clear, restorative justice practices are not as quick for either party as a traditional, you know, prison system is. You know, it's not just the victim goes to court and testifies for an hour and then goes home and waits for the verdict and maybe comes back and reads a victim impact statement. It's that they go through a whole process with a set of people who are also saying, what do you need? You know, so it's not just that they're sitting in a circle telling their terrible story over and over, but there's, you know, like they're getting, you know, what they need. They can say like, I need help finding, you know, a therapist who understands that I am Black and queer and the victim of violence. You know, every therapist I found does not understand, you know, what this means for me. Whereas, you know, and they might say, the restorative justice circle might say, okay, let's help you navigate that versus the traditional, you know, legal system, which might be like, great, you know, you need therapy, but we are not a social services model. So good luck with that.
Victoria Law, the book is Prisons Make Us Safer and 20 Other Myths About Mass Incarceration. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you for having me on again and for covering these issues.
Thanks, Victoria.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back and wrap up things on our end. I just want to read an IM that we got during the interview from, well, his handle is Sam's. Yeah, we don't need to read that. I love you guys when you have Victoria on. She's right. Prisons and generally the whole system doesn't work. I know because I went through it. I'm a former heroin addict. I got in trouble as a result of my drug use. New Mexico has like 20 prisons and one state-run rehab. So at my sentencing, I was given probation and told I had to wait 10 to 12 months for my bed at the rehab. I was homeless at the time and still addicted, so you can guess how that went. I violated 3 weeks later. I got sent to prison for 3 years. When I got there, I was told I didn't qualify for the drug rehab program in there because I wasn't serving enough time. Prison didn't do S to rehabilitate me. It was getting me extremely lucky. It was me getting extremely lucky to have a parole officer that worked with me, helped with me, and was patient with me. And even with my amazing family support, financial security, and education and job experience, not a lot of felons have. It was still extremely hard to readjust to life. I mean, those type of challenges are insurmountable for people who don't have, for many people who even have the resources. Never mind, don't. So for Emma and I, we'll be back with you tomorrow.
Yes.
And for those of you who are around, we will be back with you right now.
Still with you.
Still with you. Hey, remember, everybody, hit the like button and subscribe. Don't forget, you can also support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com is the place where you can go and subscribe. And I want to do a shout-out to DJ Cold Case. Those were the K's. In the Discord.
I like that name.
Yeah. Who compiled and played 57 versions of the Internationale on May Day, which was 2 days ago, as you remember. The playlist is in the music channel on Discord.
Cool.
So check it out, majoritydiscord.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. And lastly, the AM quickie, check it out. Things are a little calmer at the AM quickie, it feels like. We don't have as many, you know, sort of urgent stories. And so we're getting stories that maybe you don't hear of. They get lost in the the mix. Some of them maybe you just hear in the context of my headlining here. Get a little deeper. Not hugely deep, but enough to give you a little bit of context of it. And, you know, you can follow up. So check it out. AMQuickie.com. If you haven't listened in a while, check it out again. You may enjoy it. All right, we're going to head into the fun half.
Yes. Also, Left Reckoning for Matt. And
oh, right. Yes. Thank you.
Mm. Yeah. Ben Burgess was on last Thursday. Go check that out and go subscribe. We are about 800 away from 10,000 subs on YouTube. So go subscribe on YouTube, folks.
Oh, whoa. Did things get a little bit heated with Ben?
No, not really, because he doesn't really make the arguments that I don't have patience for in this cancel culture debate. He basically doesn't say it's a threat to the left, not to free speech that we're dealing with here. Basically, we don't want to assume a managerial posture, which is something that I also agree with. So we talked about that.
So, super spiciness, a little bit diffused, in other words.
Yeah, although we are a little bit drunk in the post game. So, for patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning. If we do want spiciness, or at least slurred speech, you can go to patreon.com.
Did you see the tweet he deleted about you, about being a human container who needs a haircut?
Did Glenn delete that?
No, I'm joking.
Oh, yeah. I just mean like.
No, I don't think so.
No, he stood by the human container tweet.
Well, I mean, I'm a human container. There's right. No doubt about it. I mean, we're all, in many ways, we're all human
Show
containers.
Off your posture. Hunched over.
You know what I got to do? I got to raise the table. I mean, I don't know what it is. Like,
Or lower the chair.
Well, I would raise the table because if I look at notes to my computer, it's just, like, not a good look. But, yeah, you could lower the chair.
Or we could raise the table. I don't know.
How tall are you?
About 6'3".
No.
5'11" and 3/4". Yeah, about 6 foot. Yeah. No, with shoes, I'm 6 feet, without a doubt. I'm towering over 6 feet.
I mean, this is a little high for me.
Yeah, too. Here's the problem.
I'm 5'9".
And I didn't want to bring this up at the time because it just sounds like you're whining a little bit.
Okay.
But my height is primarily in my torso.
Okay, you're not a long-legged?
I am not long-legged. I am actually almost grotesquely short-legged. And so the problem is my...
You're a hunched over torso, by the way.
Well, my torso has to hunch over. Because look at where my elbows land when I'm just doing casually. They don't even... They're 2 inches off the highest setting on my chair.
Okay. Yeah, I see that.
It's because my torso is disproportionate to my legs and my arms.
I mean, I've never noticed that, but thank you for the window into your, you know.
I mean, that's it. I mean,
now I'm not going to be able to look at you the same.
Yeah.
Finally, I'll get a little bit of understanding from people as to
like
why.
Michael Phelps. Anyway, does he have a long legs or does he have a large torso? I forget.
It's pretty much like Sam. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Michael Phelps, the greatest swimmer of all time.
Yeah. See, this is what I have to do to actually.
Do you have long arms?
No, that's the problem.
He's certainly not like Michael Phelps in that area, but you know, you might need to adjust your.
This is the problem I have. Like, I have to do this, and it hurts. It hurts to reach the elbows, and I'm not relaxing. All right. With this said, we're gonna head into the front half. 6'4", 6'2", 5'7", 39.
Do you like that posture, Glenn?
Well, it's not enough to make it about Glenn. There's other people who echoed it.
All right, well, you're 6'4", not hunched over there.
6'4", 6'2", 5'7", 39, 20. See you in the fun half. It's going to be fun. Actually, this looks pretty good.
Hey, Brendan, I got Danner.
Oh.
Ooh, late break.
In for it.
All right, folks, 6'4", 6'2", 5'7", 39, 20. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
sent us this.
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerky song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerky.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych.
Fuck 'em. Fuck 'em.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.